Chapter 8. The Eater of Lives. Confrontation. Hope in Lies. The apothecarian decks of the Endurance were cold, bare metal and reeked of the embalmer's art. Acrid chemicals fogged the air, and hissing vats of noxious fluids bubbled on retorts between dull iron slabs, suspended cryotubes, and racks of surgical equipment. Mortarion had spent altogether too much time here already in the pain-filled days following the attack of Medusan's sleeper assassins. Swathed in counterseptic wraps and bathed in regenerative poultices like an embalmed king of the Gyptia, his superhuman metabolism had taken only 7 hours to undo the worst of the damage. A squad of Death Shroud Terminators escorted him through the artificially cold space with their man-reapers gripped loosely. The Primarch's honor guard lightly rocked their outsized scythes from shoulder to shoulder to keep them in motion. Even on the flagship, they were taking no chances. Frost webbed the canted hafts, and the light of organ harvesters glittered from the ice forming on the blades. Armored in dusky white armor, edged in a mixture of crimson and olive drab, they spread out in a pyramid formation, threat auspects alert for the intruder they knew was somewhere on this deck. Mortarion went bareheaded, fresh skin grafts flushed with highly oxygenated blood that made him look healthier than he had in centuries. A rebreather gorget still covered the lower half of his face, and gusts of earthy breath sighed from its portcullis-like grill. His sockets were craters cut in a lunar landscape, his eyes nuggets of amber glass. Silence was clamped to his armor's backplate. He had no need of its edge. The death shroud had more than enough to go round. Instead, he carried the lantern, a colossal Shenlongi pistol, drum-fed and possessed of an energy matrix few beam weapons of comparable size could match. The death shroud spread out as their sweep of the chamber reached the impregnable vault at its end. Sealed with locks of magnificent complexity, the Gene Vault was a place of mystery and a repository of the Death Guard's future. Kaifa Morag, late of 24th Breacher Squad, now serving as Mortarion's equerry, shook his head and put up his bolter as he followed his master into the apothecarian. "My lord, there's no one here," he said.
"There is, Kaifa," said Mortarion,
his voice the breath of a parched desert wind.
"I can feel it."
"We've swept the deck from end to end and side to side," reaffirmed Morag. "If there was something here, we'd already have found it."
"There's still one place to look," said Mortarion.
Morag followed the Primarch's gaze.
"The Gene Vault," he said. "It's void-hardened and energy-shielded. It's a wonder the damn apothecaries can get in."
"Do you doubt me, Kaifa?" whispered Mortarion.
"Never, my lord."
"And have you ever known me to be wrong in such matters?"
"No, my lord."
"Then trust me when I say there's something in there."
"Some thing?"
Mortarion nodded, and he canted his head to one side as though listening to sounds only he could hear. The muscles in his face twitched, but with a gorget obscuring his jaw, it was impossible to be certain what expression he made.
"Open the door,"
he ordered, and a gaggle of hazard-suited Legion serfs ran to it with pneumatic key drivers and one-time cipher code wands. They inserted the power keys, but before they were engaged, a green-cloaked apothecary approached Mortarion under the watchful gaze of the Death Shroud.
"My lord," said the apothecary, "I beg you to reconsider."
"What is your name?"
asked Mortarion.
"Kore Burku, my lord."
"We have just breached Molech System Edge, Apothecary Burku, and there is an intruder aboard the Endurance," said Mortarion. "It is behind that door. I require you to open it. Now."
Kore Burku wilted under Mortarion's gaze, but to his credit, the apothecary stood his ground.
"My lord, please," said Burku. "I implore you to withdraw from the apothecarian. The gene vault must be kept sterile and at positive pressure. This entire stock of gene seed is at risk of contamination if the door is opened even a fraction."
"Nevertheless, you will do as I order," said Mortarion. "I can do it without you, apothecary, but it will take time, and in that time, what do you think an intruder might be doing in there?"
Burku considered the Primarch's words and made his way to the gleaming vault door. Numerous key drivers turned simultaneously under Burku's direction as he wandered a helix code unique to this moment and which would change immediately upon the door's opening.
The door split at its junction with the wall, and a blast of frozen, sharp-edged air escaped from within. Mortarion felt it cut the skin of his face, relishing the needle-like jab of cold. The door swung wider, and the hazard-suited thralls withdrew as the reek of preserving chemicals and frost-resistant power cells tainted the air with biomechanical flavours. Mortarion tasted something else on the air, a fetor of something so lethal that only one such as he could authorise its release. But such things were stored in the deepest magazines, locked away in vaults even more secure than this. "Touch nothing," warned Berku, moving ahead of the death shroud as they stepped over the high threshold of the gene vault. Mortarion turned to Morag and said,
"Seal the door behind me, and only open it again on my express order."
"My lord," said Morag, "after Dwell, my place is at your side."
"Not this time," said Mortarion,
and his meaning was ironclad. Devotion to duty clamped down on Morag's next words, and he nodded stiffly as Mortarion turned and followed Kore Burku into the vault. No sooner was Mortarion inside than the heavy adamantium door swung closed. The space within was a 100-meter-square vault of frost-white and gleaming silver. Shielded banks of gurgling cryo-tubes lined the walls, and rows of centrifuge drums formed a central aisle. Illuminated sigils and runic inscriptions of genetic purity flickered on brass-rimmed data slates, and Mortarion extrapolated mental maps of the gene code fragments. Here was a collection of mucronoids, there a chemical bath of zygotes that would one day be a Betcher's gland. Behind them, bubbling cylinders of eyeballs. Half-formed organs floated in gestation tanks, and puffs of vapour from humming condensers filled the air with chill moisture that crunched underfoot in microscopic ice crystals. Kore Burku claimed the atmosphere within the vault was sterile, but such was not the case. The air vibrated with potential, a thing pressing itself upon the fabric of reality like a newborn in a rupturing birth sac. Only he could feel it. Only he knew what it was. The death shroud advanced cautiously, and Mortarion sensed their confusion. To them, the vault was empty, no sign of the intruder their Primarch said they would find. That they believed their gene father might be mistaken amused him. What must it be like for a warrior of the legions to think such a thing? Much as it was for a Primarch, he supposed. But they could not sense what he could sense. Mortarion had spent a lifetime on a world where the monstrous creations of rogue geneticists and spirit-channeling corpse whisperers had haunted the fog-bound crags of Barbarus, where monsters truly worthy of the name were wrought into being every day, had even fashioned a few of his own. Mortarion knew the spore of such beasts, but more than that, he recognized the scent of one of his own.
"You see, my lord," said Apothecary Burku, "it's plain to see there's nothing here, so can we all please vacate the gene labs?"
"You're wrong," said Mortarion.
"My lord," said Burku, consulting a grainy hollow floating above his Narthesium gauntlet. "I don't understand."
"He's here. He just can't show himself yet, can you?"
The Primarch's words were addressed to the air, but the voice that answered sounded like rocks grinding against one another in a mudslide, and seemed to echo from all around them.
"Meat. Need. Meat."
Mortarion nodded, already suspecting that was why he had chosen this place. The death shroud formed a circle around Mortarion, war scythes at the ready, sensorium desperately searching for the source of the voice.
"My lord, what is that?" asked Burku.
"An old friend," said Mortarion. "One I thought lost."
No one ever thought of the Death Lord as being quick. Relentless, yes. Implacable and dogged, absolutely. But quick? No, never that. Silence was a hard, iron blur, and by the time its blade completed its circuit, all seven of the Death Shroud lay slain, simply bisected at their midriffs. An apocalyptic quantity of gore erupted within the vault, a glut of shimmering, impossibly bright blood. It sprayed the walls and flooded the polished steel deck plates in a red tide. Mortarion tasted its bitter tang. Apothecary Burku backed away from him, his eyes wide and disbelieving behind the visor of his helm. Mortarion didn't stop him. My lord, begged the apothecary, what are you doing?
Something grim, Corey, said Mortarion. Something necessary.
The air in front of Mortarion looked scratched, a phantom image of a humanoid form etched on an incredibly fine pane of glass, or a pict feed with a half-formed impression of a body on it, an outline of something that existed only as potential. The scratched, hurried impression of form stepped into the lake of blood, and gradually, impossibly, the liquid's outward spread began to reverse. Slowly, but with greater speed, as the rich fluid of all life was drawn into its ethereal form, a figure began to take shape. First a pair of feet, then ankles, calves, knees, and muscular thighs. Then pelvic bones, a spine, organs, and whipping, cording, glistening musculature wrapping itself around a wet, red skeleton. As though an invisible mould were being filled with the blood of the death shroud, the powerful form of a towering transhuman warrior took shape. Fed and fashioned from the blood of the dead, it was form without the casing of skin, a fleshless revenant with butcher's hocks of meat laced around ossified ribs, hardened femurs, and a skull like a rock. Red-rimmed eyes of madness stared out from lidless sockets, and though the body was yet freshly made, it reeked of putrefaction. The thing's mouth worked jerkily, rubbery tendons pulling taut as the exposed jawline flexed in its housing of bone. A tongue, raw and purple, ran along fresh-grown nubs of teeth. For the briefest instant, the illusion of rebirth was complete. But it didn't last. Flaccid white runnels of decomposition streaked the red meat like fatty tissue, and curls of corpse gas lifted from flesh that wriggled as though infested with feasting maggots. Weeping sores opened across the musculature, and purulent blisters popped like soap bubbles to leak viscous mucus. Glass cracked, and warning bells began chiming. Mortarion looked to his left as one by one the bell jars of developing zygotes exploded with uncontrolled growth. Rampant necrosis swelled from algal fronds of stem cells and nascent buds of organs. Veined with black, they grew and grew until the bloated mass ruptured with flatulent brays of stinking fumes. Chemical baths curdled in an instant, their surfaces frothing with scum and overflowing in glutinous ropes. The centrifuges vibrated as the specimens within expanded and mutated with ultra-rapid growth before dying just as quickly. Behind the Primarch, Apothecary Burku was desperately trying to manipulate one of the key drivers while punching in a code that had already been rendered obsolete.
"Please, my lord," he shouted. "It's contamination. We have to get out of here right now. Hurry before it's too late."
"It's already too late," said the wet, fleshless thing of glistening organs. Burku turned and his eyes widened in horror at the sight of an oozing weave of translucent skin coating the monster's body. It grew and thickened over the naked organs, unevenly and in patches, but expanding all the time. Decay claimed the skin almost as soon as it grew, flaking from the body in blood-blackened scabs. The monster's hand punched out. Its fingers stabbed through Burku's eye lenses. The apothecary wailed and dropped to his knees as the monster tore the helmet from his head. Burku's sockets were ruined craters, gaping wounds in his skull that wept bloody tears down ashen cheeks. But losing his eyes was the least of Kore Burku's pain. His cries turned to gurgling retching. The apothecary's chest spasmed as lungs genhanced to survive in the most hostile environments were assaulted from within by a pathogen so deadly it had no equal. The apothecary vomited a flood of rancid matter, falling onto all fours as he was devoured by his hyper-accelerated immune system. Death fluids leaked from every orifice, and Mortarion watched dispassionately as the flesh all but melted from his bones, like the humans of Barbarus who climbed too high into the poison fogs and paid the ultimate price. His brothers would be horrified by Burku's death and his abhorrent murderer, but Mortarion had seen far worse in his youth. The monstrous kings of the Dark Mountains were endlessly inventive in their anatomical abominations. Kore Burku slumped forward, and a slurry of stinking black and vermilion spilled onto the deck. The apothecary's body was no more, a broth of decaying meat and spoiled fluids. Mortarion knelt beside the remains and ran a finger through the mess.
He brought the sludge to his face and sniffed. The biological poison was a planetary exterminator, but to one raised in the toxic hell of Barbaros, it was little more than an irritant. Both his fathers had worked to render his physiology proof against any infection, no matter its power.
"The Life-Eater virus," said Mortarion.
"That's what killed me," said the monster, as the regenerating and decaying cloak of skin slithered over its body. "So that's what the warp used to remake me."
Mortarion watched as waxen skin inched over the skull to reveal a face he'd last seen en route to the Eisenstein. No sooner was it revealed than it rotted away again, an unending cycle of rebirth and death. Even bereft of skin, Mortarion knew the face of one of his sons.
"Commander," said Mortarion, "welcome back to the Legion."
"We go to the killing fields, my lord."
"The War Master calls us to Moloch," said Mortarion.
"My lord," said Ignatius Grulgor, turning his limbs over to better examine the reeking, living death of his diseased body and finding it much to his liking. "I am yours to command. Unleash me. I am the Eater of Lives."
"All in good time, my son," said Mortarion. "First you're going to need some decent armor, or you'll kill everyone on my ship."
It was bad enough when the occupants of the nameless fortress prison had been unknown to Loken, but knowing he had no choice except to leave Mercedes incarcerated cut him to the bone. The cell door closing was a knife in the belly, but she was right. With agents of the War Master likely abroad in the solar system, perhaps even on Terra itself, there existed no prospect of her release. Perhaps his escort sensed the build-up of anger in him, for they led him back to the embarkation deck without the needless obfuscation of the route. As Loken had suspected, his final destination had been close to where the Tarnhelm had set down. The sleek ship sat in a launch cradle, already prepped and ready to depart. Bror Tyrfinger had called it a Draugrujukur, a ghost ship, and he was right to do so, but not for its stealthy properties. It carried people who might as well be ghosts, presences that went unnoticed by all, and more importantly, whose existence would never be acknowledged. Loken saw Banu Rasua in the pilot's blister on the arrowhead frontal section, and Ares Wojtek circled the craft with Tyrfinger, using his servo arms to point out especially noteworthy elements of the ship's construction. Tyrfinger looked up at Loken's approach, his brow furrowed as though detecting a noisome stench or the approach of an enemy. His eyes roamed Loken's face and his hand slipped to his holster.
"Oh," said Tyrfinger, "there's a man whose ice runners slipped the sheet. You found trouble?"
Loken ignored him and climbed the rear ramp to the fuselage. The central dormitory section was only half full. Kalyon Zaven sat at the central table with Tubal Cain, extolling the virtues of personal combat over massed escalades. At the far end, Varun and Nohai compared scars on their bulging forearms, while Rama Karian cleaned the disassembled skeleton of his rifle. Tylos Rubio was nowhere to be seen, and crews emerged from the low-ceilinged passageway leading to the pilot's compartment.
"Good, you're back," said Zaven,
managing to completely misread Loken's humours.
"Perhaps we can actually get out of the system."
"Crews," snapped Loken, reaching to his belt. "This is for you." Loken's wrist snapped out, and the lacquered wooden box flew from his hand like a throwing blade. It flashed towards Cruz, and though the half-herd was no longer as quick as he once was, he caught the box a finger's breadth from his chest.
"What?"
he said, but Loken didn't let him finish. Loken's fist slammed into Cruz's face like a pile driver. The venerable warrior staggered, but didn't fall, his heartwood too seasoned to be felled by one blow. Loken gave him three more, one after the other, with bone-crunching force. Cruz bent double, instinctively driving forward into the fists of his attacker. Loken slammed a knee into Cruz's gut, then spun low to drive an elbow to the side of his head. Skin split, and Cruz dropped to his knees. Loken kicked him in the chest. The half-herd flew back into the lockers, crumpling steel with the impact. Buckled doors flew open, and the stowed gear tumbled to the deck. A combat blade, leather strops, two pistols, whetstones, and numerous ammunition clips. The knights errant scattered at the sudden violence in their midst, but none moved to intervene. Loken was on crews in a heartbeat, his fists like wrecking balls as they slammed into the half-herd. Crews wasn't fighting back. Teeth snapped under Loken's assault. Blood sprayed the bare metal of his armor. Loken's fury at Mercedes' imprisonment cast a red shadow over everything. He wanted to kill Cruz like he'd never wanted to kill anyone before. With every ringing hammer blow he unleashed, he heard his name being called. He was back in the ruins, surrounded by death and creatures more corpse than living thing. He felt their claws upon his armor, pulling him upright. He threw them off, tasting the planet-wide reek of decaying meat and the hot iron of expended munitions. He was Cerberus again, right in the heart of it, lost to madness on the killing fields of Istvan. Spitting breath, Loken swept up the combat blade. The edge glittered in the subdued lighting, hanging in the air like an executioner waiting his master's sign. And for an instant, Loken wasn't looking at Cruz, but little Horus Aximand, the melancholic killer of Taric Torghadon. The blade plunged down, aimed for Cruz's exposed throat. It stopped a centimetre from flesh, as though striking an unseen barrier. Loken screamed and pushed with every scrap of strength, but the blade refused to budge. The handle froze in his grip, blistering the skin with arctic ferocity before turning it black with frostbite. The pain brought clarity, and Loken looked up to see Tylos Rubio with his hand extended and wreathed in a haze of corpuscent.
"Drop it, Garvey,"
said a voice, though he could not say for certain to whom it belonged. Loken couldn't feel his hand, the icy touch of Rubio's psychery numbing it completely. He surged to his feet and hurled the blade away. It shattered into icy fragments on the curved fuselage.
"Thrown, Loken! What was that about?"
demanded Nohai, pushing past him to kneel by Cruz's slumped form.
"You've damn near killed him!"
Cruz demurred, but his words were too mangled by swollen lips and broken teeth to make out. The faces of the warriors around him were pictures in shock. They looked at Loken as they would a lunatic berserker. Loken went to go to Cruz, but Varan stepped in front of him. Braw Tyrfinger stood next to him.
"The old man is down," said Tyrfinger. "Leash your wolf, now."
Loken ignored him, but Varan put a hand on his chest, a solid, immovable brace. If he wanted past, he'd have to fight the former World Eater, too.
"Whatever this is," said Varan, "this isn't the time."
Varan's words were calmly said, and Loken's anger diminished with every heartbeat. He nodded and stepped back with his fists uncurling. The sight of his brother legionary's blood dripping from his cracked knuckles was the final parting of the curtain, and reason resumed its position at the seat of his consciousness.
"I'm done," he said, backing away until he reached a wall and slumped down to his haunches.
His assault had not exerted him overmuch, but his chest heaved with effort.
"Good. I'd hate to have to kill you," said Tyrfinger, taking a seat at the table. "And by the way, you owe me a knife. I spent weeks getting that one balanced properly."
"Sorry," said Loken, watching Nohai work on Cruz's ruined face.
"Ach, it's only a blade," said Tyrfinger, "and it was Tylos here that broke it with that witchery of his."
"Me?" said Rubio. "I stopped Loken from murder."
"Couldn't you have plucked the blade from his hand?" asked Tubal Cain, examining the broken fragments of the blade. "I once saw a psyker of the 15th Legion pluck the blades from an Eldar swordsman's hands, so I know it can be done. Or was the Librarius of Ultramar less skilled than that of Prospero?"
Rubio ignored Cain's jibe and made his way back to his private compartment bunk. Loken pushed himself to his feet and crossed the deck towards Cruz. Varan and Tyrfinger moved to intercept him, but he shook his head.
"I only want to talk," he said.
Varan nodded and stepped aside, but kept his posture taut. Loken looked down at Cruz, whose eyes were all but obscured by swollen flesh. Clotted blood matted his beard, and purple bruising flowered all across the half-herd's face. Impressions of Loken's gauntlets were battered into his skin. Nohai was clearing the blood away, but that wasn't making the damage Loken had inflicted look any less severe. Cruz lifted his head at the sound of his approach. seemingly unafraid of further violence. "How long did you know she was here?" said Loken, the calmness of his voice in stark contrast to the fading colour of his skin. Cruz mopped his cheek where the skin had split and spat a wad of bloody phlegm. At first, Loken thought he wasn't going to answer, but when the words came, they came without rancour.
"Almost 2 years."
2 years, said Loken, and his fingers curled back into fists.
"Go on," said Cruz softly. "Get it out of your system, lad. Beat me some more, if it helps."
"Shut up, Yakton," said Nohai, "and Loken, step back, or I'll seriously reconsider my apothecary's oath."
"You left her to rot in there for 2 years, Yakton," said Loken. "After you'd risked everything to save her and the others, Euphrates and Kirill, where are they? Are they here too?"
"I don't know where they are," said Cruz.
"Why should I believe you?"
"Because it's the truth, I swear," said Cruz,
grimacing as Nohai inserted another needle into his skull.
"Nathaniel might have an idea where they are, but I don't."
Loken paced the deck, angry and confused and hurt.
"Why didn't you tell me?" he asked,
as the hulking shape of a gold-armoured warrior appeared silhouetted at the boarding ramp.
"Because I ordered him not to," said Rogal Dorn.
A space was cleared for the Primarch of the Imperial Fists, though he declined to sit. Chairs were righted and the debris of the recently unleashed violence cleared away. Loken sat the farthest distance he could manage from Yakton Cruz, a terrible weight of shame hanging around his neck. The fury that had driven him to assault the half-herd had dissipated utterly, though the lie between them still soured his belly. Rogal Dorn paced the length of the table, his arms folded across his chest. His granite-hard face was stern and heavy with duty, as though ill news still swathed him. His armor's golden luster was faded, but here on this hidden fortress, nothing of beauty could shine.
"You were hard on Yakton," said Dorn,
and the square tones of his voice reminded Loken of how astonishingly soft it had once been. Soft, yet with steel in its bones. That steel was still there, but all softness had been stripped away.
"No more than he deserved," replied Loken. He was being churlish, but even Jenhant's livers took time to purge black bile. "You know that's not true," said Dorn, as Ares Wojtek set a cut-down fuel canister in the centre of the table. "Yakton was obeying an order from the Lord Protector of Terra. You would do the same."
The last sentence was as much a challenge as it was a statement of fact, and Loken nodded slowly. The months following Loken's return from Istvan had shown him the depths of Rogal Dorn's displeasure as he was pared down to the bone for signs of treachery. That Malkador and Garrow had vouchsafed him loyal was perhaps all that had saved him from an executioner's blade.
"I recall when I first met you aboard the Vengeful Spirit, Garviel Loken," said Dorn. "You and Taric almost came to blows with Efreid, and my first captain."
Loken nodded, reluctant to be drawn into reminiscence even with a being as godly as a Primarch. He heard the pause where he expected to hear Sigismund's name and wondered what, if anything, it meant. Ares Wojtek filled the silence by distributing tin cups around the table via his servo arms and pouring a measure of clear liquid into each one.
"What's this you're giving me, Ares?" said Dorn,
as Wojtek handed him the first filled cup.
"It's called Dizra, my lord," explained Wojtek. "It's what the clans of Medusa drink when there's bridges to be mended between brothers."
"And you just happened to have some aboard?"
Loken looked at the clear liquid in the cup, smelling all manner of strange mixtures in its chemical structure.
"Not exactly," said Wojtek, "but there's enough alcohol-based fluids aboard the Tarnhelm for someone with a working knowledge of alchemical processes to knock up a viable substitute. Normally a clan chief would pass a Payala bowl around his warring sons, but I think we can break protocol on that. Just this once."
"Just this once," agreed Dorn, and took a drink.
The Primarch's eyebrow raised a fraction, which should have told Loken what to expect. He followed Lord Dorne's example and swallowed a mouthful of Wojtek's spirit. Its heat was chemical and raw, like coolant drained from the core of a plasma reactor. Loken's body could process almost any toxin and expel it as harmless waste product, but he doubted the Emperor had Disraeli in mind when conceiving the Legionis Astartes physiology. The others around the table, crews included, drank from their cups. All apart from Bror Tyrfinger and Alta Nohai reacted as though Wojtek had tried to poison them, but kept their reactions to coughs and splutters. Dorne's gaze swept the warriors at the table and said, "I know little of Medusan customs, but if the drinking of this Disra has served its clans well, then let its purpose be echoed here." Dorne leaned over the table, pressing both palms to its surface. "Your mission is too important to fail through internal division. Every one of you is here because you have strengths and virtues that have cleft you from your parent legions. Malkador trusts you, though some of you have yet to earn such from me. I hold deeds, not faith, gut feelings, or the whispers of prognosticators as the sum of a warrior's character. Let this mission be what earns you the boon of my trust. Find what the Wolf King needs, and you will have earned the Sigillite a measure of that trust, too." "Why were you and Cruz here, my lord?" asked Mesa Varan without embarrassment. Loken saw a conspiratorial glance pass between Rogal Dorne and Yakton Cruz. The half-herd dropped his gaze, and Rogal Dorne let out a heavy sigh that made Varan wish he'd never asked. "To kill a man I once held in high esteem," said Dorne, ever unwilling to shirk from the truth. "A good man, sent to his death by Horus to sap our resolve and unbind the mortar that holds the Imperium together." Loken swallowed another mouthful of Zira, and the shame keeping him pinned to his seat receded enough for him to ask, "My lord, do you know where Euphrati Keeler and Kirill Sinderman are?" Dorne shook his head. "No, Loken, I do not, save that they are not on Terra. I am as ignorant of their whereabouts as Yakton, but if I had to guess, and I'm loath to guess, I'd say they were somewhere on Rodinia right now. They move from plate to plate, hidden by their followers and aided by deluded fools. There were reports she had been seen on Antilia and Valbara, and even around the globe and Lemuria. I hear reports of her sermonizing all across the orbital ring, but I suspect a great deal of those are false dissemination to throw the hunters off the scent. Surely one woman isn't worth that effort," said Kane. "Mistress Keeler is more than just one woman," said Dorne. "This saint nonsense that sprung up around her is more dangerous than you know. Her words fill malleable hearts with false faith and the expectation of miraculous intervention. She imbues the Emperor with divine powers, and if he is a god, what need has he of his people to defend him? No, the Lectio Divinitatus is just the sort of invented lunacy the Emperor sought to see ended with unity." "Perhaps her words give people hope," said Loken. "Hope in lies," replied Dorne, folding his arms and stepping away from the table. His brief time with them was over. The Primarch made his way to the boarding ramp, but turned and said one last thing before departing for Terra. "I own only the empirical clarity of imperial truth." Loken knew those words well. He'd said them once in the water garden on 6319, and many times since in the dungeons of Terra. It could be no coincidence that Rogal Dorne repeated them here. The memory of them was a reminder of sundered confraternity, oaths broken, and brothers murdered in cold blood. "As do I," said Loken. But Rogal Dorne was already gone.